Vinny.
Hi, Nancy.
Welcome to episode 55 of the Front Porch Book Club.
The Front Porch Book Club is a podcast that meets twice a month.
We like to dig deep into the relationship between characters and the worlds they live in.
Grab your book and iced tea and join us on the front porch.
Okay, Lenny, after I read this book, I felt like we missed an opportunity to have this book be our Mother's Day book.
Oh.
I mean, I didn't know it was going to be so centered on the mom, Margaret, and the boy, Bird, because that's really what I felt that this whole novel was about, and how this mother loves her son and all that she will give up and do for him. So do you think we're going to be able to get through this without crying?
Well, maybe it's a good thing we didn't do it for Mother's Day.
There you go.
There
probably
could be some hope for us, but who knows? Well, our book for June is Our Missing Hearts by Celeste Ng. This novel was a New York Times instant bestseller and a Reese's Book Club pick. It was published just about 6 months ago, so we're getting it hot off the presses.
You bet.
The author previously wrote Little Fires Everywhere that our listeners may have read or watched on the Hulu series starring Kerry Washington and Reese Witherspoon.
I have never read any of Celeste Ng's books before, so I didn't know what I would think, but I'll tell you, I love this novel. It's set in the near future in the United States, and our country has become an authoritarian state that removes children from families who don't profess the approved ideologies. And the action centers around Bird. He's a 12-year-old boy. His mother has disappeared from his and his father's lives years earlier when her poetry started being used by the resistance. The inciting incident is he receives a mysterious letter that sets him on a journey to find out what happened to his mom.
There's a lot in this book, Nance.
Yeah.
We got the mom thing, the parental love of her.
Yeah.
And actually, it ends up being the father, too,'s love for Bird.
Yes.
Discrimination, prejudice, friendship, and an overarching question of how far you might be willing to go to protect your child and create a better world for him.
Yeah. I don't think there's any way to really talk about this book without talking about it in its entirety. So it's going to be full of spoiler alerts. So, So for any of our listeners who do not want to know what happens, turn us off and turn us back on after you've read the book. Definitely read the book. Don't miss that opportunity. So I've already mentioned that I love this novel. I'm anxious to hear, what did you think of it?
I'll tell you, I really liked it too. I didn't know anything about it when I picked it up. I thought it was very smart.
Yes. Okay. In what way?
I thought she did such a clever job of creating a believable situation of how you would take the United States. And I see you shaking your head.
I am.
And creating this culture that ends up being this authoritative state and the slippery slope that there is to getting there.
I absolutely thought so too. I don't read a lot of dystopian novels, but a lot of times when I read one, I'll think, yeah, I don't really see that reasonably happening. That feels like people who are living in a society that feels like it's a great distance from the society we live in.
Right.
This book does feel very near future. I agree with you. She creates this history of how the United States, sometime probably in the 20 teens, it feels like, started slipping. And it starts with an economic crisis, and then there's some world affairs, there's a lot of civil unrest, and then you have a Congress and a president who is poised to reinstate order in the country, and they reach just far enough that then suddenly you're sliding down this slope. And now we live in a country where everyone looks out for one another.
Except for when your kids are being taken. They look out for one another unless it's you that's being beaten on the street.
Exactly.
In this novel, we're having a hard economic time. We look around and go, you know, China seems like they have enough to eat over there. They're doing okay. It must be them. Yeah. They must be suppressing us. They must be abusing us in some way.
Right.
And so then you start, oh, well, we don't like China right now. Mm-hmm. Oh, then we don't like Chinese people.
Right.
Then, oh, the Americans that are in our country, oh, we don't like them either because mm-hmm. they're from China. And right. then what are we going to do about it?
Right. Well, we're going to, you know, push them down staircases. We're going right. to abuse them on the street. We're going to
take their children.
Take their children. Yeah, we're going to do a lot of things to them, which unfortunately not so different than what happened during COVID when everyone was blaming China for COVID. I mean, obviously it started there. And then there were all these attacks on Chinese Americans or anyone who seemed like they might be Chinese American. I mean, it also shows the ignorance of the United States, like beating Absolutely. Up people from Thailand because they kind of look like they might be from China.
We can't figure out who the Chinese are. So they've all got to. Right. I mean, it's right. horrible. Okay. So here's another incident, Nance. Margaret is the mother. She's talking to a Choctaw grandmother who tells her that there is a time in her history that the U.S. had a policy of separating parents from their children.
Yeah.
She tells Margaret about the Carlisle Indian School just up the road, about 30 miles.
That's true. That's very close to where you live.
Where thousands of Native children were sent between 1879 through 1918. The idea was to assimilate students into the mainstream culture. And this is what it says, kill the Indian to save the man. It's not like it stopped after that. After World War II, government authorities removed thousands of American Indian children from their families and placed them in non-Indian foster care and adoptive homes. And in the late 1960s, an estimated 25 to 35% of American Indian children had been separated from their families.
Shocking.
Now, because I am close to Carlisle, this gets in our news sometimes. Mm-hmm. People are now going, huh, maybe we need to look back on this part of our history.
Yeah, 100 years ago.
Come to terms from it, learn from it, and see what we should be doing about that. Mm-hmm. So there is a Carlisle Indian School project, and I'd like to put that on our website
yep.
because it does talk about what is happening. There's recently an Associated Press report, and it just came out like last week, I think it was May 25th, that five more remains of Native American children were found, and they're going to be disinterred and returned this fall. So they're still looking at this. They're still trying to come to terms with it, get the word out there on what happened. So it was nice to see that it hit this book to draw some attention towards it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because it also added credence for people who might not be familiar with what we were doing to the indigenous population in terms of separating children from their parents. If people weren't aware of that, they would think, well, I don't think the United States would ever get to the point that they would separate children from parents. But there's more. The same Choctaw grandmother alludes to our recent policy of separating children from their parents at our southern border and keeping them in cages. And I think she specifically refers to that, keeping children in cages.
Okay. That didn't happen that long ago, Nancy, but today that the hairs on the back of my neck stick straight up that was ever tolerated and that that went on as long as it did. It still angers me to no point. Just now is the time I'm going to start crying because that was horrible.
That was
horrible. We allowed that in our government in this day and age. Totally zero, 100% not acceptable.
Mm-hmm.
That is another black stain on our history.
It absolutely is. This was largely during the Trump administration. It was a means, they thought, to reduce illegal migration into our country, because if parents understood they would be separated from their children, the thought was, well, they would never cross the border to begin with. Of course, most parents didn't even understand that that was U.S. policy because it happened so quickly.
This was undercover.
And in fact, they denied even doing it months and months and months later. They were still publicly denying it.
Absolutely. Until people got in there with their little spyware and started taking pictures.
Yeah.
And politicians demanded that they be able to go in there. I think humanitarian groups demanded that they go in there too.
The famous example was an old warehouse in McAllen, Texas, where hundreds of children were being kept in a series of cages made of metal fencing. The Associated Press reported that overhead lighting stays on around the clock. Children sleep under large foil sheets. Older children are forced to change the diapers of toddlers, and the children have no books or toys. Over 5,000 children have been separated from their parents. And as of February 2023, the United States still has not succeeded in reunifying about 1,000 children.
And why do you think that the government can't do this?
When it came to light that children were being separated from their parents, one of the immediate questions was, how are you going to start reunifying these families? And the Department of Justice had no clear pathway to doing that.
Because this shouldn't have been a policy anyway. Nance?
Well, the Biden administration, one of the first things they did when they came into office was declare that the reunifications would happen. And from what I've read, there aren't great records. These are parents who are in a very transient point in their lives. They are trying to enter another country. Even here in the United States, they might be difficult to find, but certainly if they've been sent back over the border, they're very difficult to find. Now, the United States apparently is working with a lot of not-for-profit organizations in countries south of our borders trying to find these parents, but it is no easy task, unfortunately.
It's not. Ay, what we do. All right, well, now, one of the things that bothered me about the southern border incident with these children was that the trauma that they are going to be facing, not only as they're in these cages separated from their families, but also in years to come, working through what happened to them.
Yeah.
So let's talk about Bird and Bird's trauma. Bird has a mother who has disappeared, and she's living her life, and she's raising Bird along with her husband, and her head's kind of down, and she sees that the culture is discriminating against her. Now, of course, this happens, as it typically does, over a span of time, just like right between World War I and World War II in Germany. This happens over a period of time. You just don't flip the switch and all of a sudden start taking children from parents. So she starts seeing discrimination against her parents, and she holds up in a middle-class environment, not really affected so much by it, but it grows. And of course, she is affected. She's affected because she's Chinese descendant, but she's also has written some poetry that has been published and the resistance has taken part of her poetry, and they have used that as sort of a flag for their cause.
Which is funny because she never even originally wrote it from a perspective of resistance. She was writing about being a mom. She was writing about her daily walks around her Cambridge neighbor. Like she wasn't writing these poems in a spirit of resistance, but there are some phrases, one of them being "Our Missing Hearts," that the resistance picks up and starts using as part of their kind of battle cry.
Yeah. So she then sees the writing on the wall that she's being attacked. Okay. People are looking at her like, oh, she must be part of the resistance because she's the one who wrote this poetry. And so she's starting to see, okay, they're going to take Bird from us. What am I going to do? And she makes the heartbreaking decision that she has to leave the family because at least Bird will be raised by his father. And she just leaves.
Yep.
And so for 3 years, he doesn't know where she went, what she did. He asked Dad about it. He doesn't want to talk to him about it. He sees what's happening in the government. He's like 9 years old, and he's been enculturated now into this. This is what you do to be patriotic. So his father doesn't stand up against the government, because if he spouts anti-government stuff, Bird is going to, and then he's going to be removed from his father.
And Bird hears his father whenever anyone asks about his mom. His father says, we have nothing to do with her. We don't believe what she believes. We're glad she's gone. We have nothing to do with her. So that's what he hears his father talking about.
Right. Because that's the message that he wants Bird to give. Mm-hmm. Even though we realize, as the book goes on, that he still loves his wife. He loves Bird, but he has to say these things so that Bird doesn't get taken from him.
Yeah. So here's my question. So Bird's mom basically disappears. She's gone for 3 years. What did you think about the representation of Bird being so confused by that, but he of course wants to be reunited with his mom, he thinks, but he kind of hates her because she left on her own volition. It's not like people came and took her away. She just said, I have to go, and she was gone.
Yeah. I really liked the way the author took his experiences and then mirrored them with the other little girl who was taken away, Sadie. Now she is being removed from her parents. And so her experience of being removed from the family and how she responds to it is very different than Bird's.
Yeah.
So I would say that Bird probably, and every child deals with trauma differently, of course, but Bird had the safety net of his father still being at home. And yet his life changed drastically. They were not living a middle-class life anymore. All of a sudden they were living probably under the poverty line. His mm-hmm. father did not have a classy job anymore. He had a very minimal job. So he did experience the trauma of mom leaving. He didn't know what happened to her, but he missed her love. Sadie, on the other hand, is way out of her comfort zone. She actually runs away. So that's a typical, I think, trauma response in a lot of ways. She is seeking out her parents. She is so much more worldly.
Yeah.
She is more knowledgeable. She has differences of opinion, and she will say what it is that she wants to say. I liked the way that there were these two characters that experienced the trauma, but they experienced it very differently.
I really like the Sadie character also. I thought that was a really good kind of point, counterpoint. And it's really Sadie's character very early in the book that starts introducing a cynicism about this pact policy, which is the congressional policy that made all this possible. And PACT serves for Preserving American Culture and Traditions Act, which is another in a long line of euphemistic congressional legislation. She is the first one who starts saying, look around. Don't you understand what's happening? I can talk about what's happening to me. I was taken away from my parents. And Byrd's like, you must be one in a million. No, I am not one in a million. And she talks about how she's been discriminated against because her parents didn't have the right ideology, and therefore she is suspect. And this is not a Chinese American girl. This is someone who would look like a very, I think, European American, basically, heritage-wise. And she's been taken away because of the ideological question. And she's trying to tell Byrd, who is her best friend, the two of them complete outcasts in their school. She's trying to convince Byrd what's really happening and trying to open his eyes to that. So I really did like that friendship. I like that relationship. Byrd gets the stink eye from a lot of people because his mom is Chinese American. So he has some Asian characteristics in his face that are obliquely referred to. There's an example in the book. They're at a pizza place, and the guy working at the pizza place just absolutely refuses to serve a Chinese American man.
Yep.
And yells at him and tells him to get out. And the poor guy's hungry. There aren't any other places that are open. He's like, no, you got to leave. We don't serve your kind. This whole question, though, of the Chinese Americans, the children being separated from their parents. Another thing this really made me think of was the internment camps in the United States during World War II. Just because of how you look in our country's fairly recent history, you were interned and you lost everything that you had been building in terms of your own personal wealth.
Just so devastating.
And then speaking of wealth, then there's Dami.
Yeah, Dami. What do you want to say about Dami?
I thought Dami was a great representation of another way of getting through the United States' economic crises, which, again, not so different from COVID. She comes from this fabulously wealthy family. She has rejected her father and all his wealth when Margaret meets her and there are two 20-somethings knocking around New York trying to survive, living in terrible housing with lots of roommates and basically scrounging around for jobs, delivering mail between people in the city. But Dami, after Margaret marries Ethan, much to Dami's chagrin, Dami then later decides to ask her father for help. And she rides out the rest of the economic crisis in a nice little cabin in Vermont. And dad and stepmother end up dying in a plane crash. They're vacationing to somewhere or another. So then Dami becomes the sole heir of a huge technological corporation. And, you know, has a very different experience with all of this because she is able to buy off the police. She's able to live a pretty good life still in the middle of all of this.
Yeah, but she gives back.
Because she's making these little contributions to groups that are helping. And then when she and Margaret get together, they're kind of an unstoppable force, the two of them.
Yeah. I like the character. I like that she's sort of a grassroots kind of person. And that she rejects the money early on in her life. And then she realizes, hey, I can do some good with this money. I can save children. I can help connect children back to their parents. Mm-hmm. So I liked her character. But Nancy, I just had to laugh. Because for me, it seems like most people who are writers love reading. There is a connection here.
Oh, a very, very strong connection.
So who are the heroes in this story?
Librarians.
The librarians.
Absolutely.
So the author is looking around and going, who should they hear? You know, I really like librarians. Now, as a group of people, I'm sorry if I diss anybody who's a librarian. That probably would not have been my choice for a hero group, but they are the heroes.
Librarians are definitely the heroes. And I love that librarians are the heroes.
I knew you would. I knew it. I knew it. I'm like, Nancy's going to love this.
Because librarians, they know a lot. They love knowledge. Yeah, they're always trying to get to the truth. And what I really loved is the mechanism of this subversive network they build is around interlibrary loan. Which, okay, first of all, I love interlibrary loan.
You actually use that
all the time. All the time, Linda.
I've never used that.
I have gotten hundreds of books through interlibrary loan.
I know you have.
Even within our own library system here in Lincoln, I'm constantly getting books through interlibrary loan. And through the university library, I can get any book that has been published practically. I've only run up against one or two books I haven't been able to get. But yeah, I can get any book anywhere, from anywhere. It's great. So that is the little subversive mechanism. When she started describing it, I was like, interlibrary loan?
And I read it going, interlibrary loan. Interesting.
And even the dad, Ethan, is a librarian as well.
Yeah, I picked up on that. Yeah.
And Bird goes to the library to start figuring out the puzzle of this letter that he gets. Libraries, they've got too much information, so he's not allowed to even go to certain parts of the library. Well, and book banning. Books are a little suspicious. They have to be kept under wraps. And these librarians are there very quietly exchanging little pieces of information hidden in books that are being sent to other libraries all over the United States.
It's just amazing.
I love it.
All the names then of these children are somehow Sadie's smart enough to realize that if she goes to the library, these librarians are not only going to help her try to find her parents, they also house her. And so they have her in hiding.
Sadie's gone underground.
The librarians have her. Again, they're the heroes. We are the safe sanctuary of knowledge and people.
Anyone who writes, I agree with you, has spent many, many happy hours in libraries feeling like libraries might be the very best place in the world. In fact, I was just at the library myself for like 3 hours yesterday morning. I was so happy there.
I know you are. Libraries are kind of like hospitals to me.
Oh, no.
I got to go to the library.
No,
okay,
no,
I'm going to
no.
get in, get out.
No.
Oh. Yeah.
I found this great table that had a window that looked out over a natural prairie. And I just sat there and read and looked around at books and would come back to my little table and had a few chats with librarians as they wandered by.
Ooh,
and
yeah. Now that's nice.
Yeah, it was lovely. Absolutely lovely. Okay, so another thing I really like about this book is how the story opens. And when it opens, we're really getting Bird's perspective on where he is in his life. Pretty quickly, we find out that he's been completely ostracized by his classmates. We're pretty clear that the learning that he is getting in school about PACT, he kind of believes that PACT is keeping everyone safe. We don't know why his mom disappeared or where she is, because again, this is everything from Bird's perspective. We're not sure why his father, who was a professor at Harvard, now works in the library instead of teaching. We don't know why they moved from their lovely, lovely home after his mom disappeared to a dorm room, basically, and eat at the cafeteria. his dad just seems really overly protective, really harsh, maybe even uncaring at the beginning of the book. He's very harsh about his former wife. Like we talked about, he's like, no, we don't believe any of that. We're glad she's gone. And you think, boy, that's kind of rough. Mm-hmm. But then as we get into the book, their lives start opening up and we start hearing Margaret's story too. This is also, I thought, for me, a very realistic part of the story. She never set out to be a dissident. I mean, she's just, like you said, kind of an everyday person. She realized that there was some discrimination going on that impacted her directly. Her father is basically killed when he's pushed down some subway stairs, and her mom dies the next day, that you get a sense probably from the shock of all of that. So it's not like she's unaware of it, but she basically just wants to keep her head down at this point. She has her little baby bird. She has her husband who she loves very much. She's just trying to get through it, as of course many people are just trying to get through life. Then, of course, notoriety is forced upon her when her poems are picked up by the resistance. And she leaves because she wants to keep Bird safe. And it's only that she goes to visit the parents of a young woman who has been killed that she starts to understand, again, kind of as we're learning that Bird is learning, the scale of what is happening and that children are being removed. And this really catalyzes for her the idea that it's not just about keeping my own child safe. I need to start thinking about how I can make the world better for him. And that's a huge step that then really kind of propels the rest of her story. But I liked Margaret a lot. I understood her maternal instinct and saw how it was a series of steps that really took her believably to being someone who then becomes involved in this resistance.
Yeah, the love that she had for Bird, he didn't quite realize it.
Right.
The other thing about trauma, and I didn't mention this, is that when they got back together, it wasn't an immediate connection.
No.
Right. It doesn't erase the last 3 years of his life.
Right.
It isn't that they pick up where they left off. That's not going to happen either. And I thought that was really very realistic about their relationship.
And heartbreaking because he's her bird, but he's also changed. And so for her, she's like searching for her little boy, but he's kind of becoming a young man. And she sees kind of echoes of the boy she knew, but
he doesn't even go by Bird anymore.
He doesn't go by Bird
anymore.
That
was his mom's name for him.
Right.
Not his name.
Right.
And I like that too, because it made it very realistic that he is not the boy that she left. The sweet, endearing little relationship. They had their own little world. It was very sweet, very imaginative. And that also was very believable because she joined Bird the way children are so easily caught up in imaginary play. And she joined in that and probably fanned the flames of that a lot based on the culture and the stories and the folklore that she heard growing up. Yeah. She instilled some of that with Bird so that he would know those stories too. I liked Margaret. I liked the person that she was to Bird. I was disappointed kind of at the end that she was not present enough to stop her actions.
Yeah. But she was talking about Bird. She was proclaiming her love of Bird.
I know. But I would have stopped and said, I'm out of here.
Yeah.
Because if I could have figured out a way to see Bird and keep him safe and start building back my relationship with him. And I know that she was trying to create a better world for all of us, and that was the choice that she made. But you know, Nance, I do like a happy ending.
I know.
And I wanted her just to stop and get away from the police and be able to see Bird yeah. and have a relationship with him underground or whatever.
Yeah.
So I was sad to see that end.
That was a very sad ending.
Yeah.
But again, it felt so realistic. You think about in countries all over the world where people are giving their lives to stand up against injustices and their families never really know exactly what happens to them. And some of these actions end up sparking a flame, which is what the author intimates in this story, that it was her stand that started sparking even greater resistance and change.
Right.
But a heartbreaking ending for sure.
Yeah. Well, we got through it. No one cried, Nance, except for me, a little bit weepy at the one part.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, well, there is a lot to talk about in this book, and I'm really excited about the special guest we have coming to talk with us the next time. And we're going to explore more about the U.S. history of separating children and parents, particularly in the indigenous population. Our guest is Dr. Margaret Jacobs. She's a professor of history and director of the Center for Great Plains Studies at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. She studies historical indigenous child removal and how government authorities in the U.S., Australia, and Canada continue to remove indigenous children, and on how indigenous women mobilize to reclaim the care of their children. Her latest book is After 100 Winters, In Search of Reconciliation on America's Stolen Lands, published by Princeton University Press.
Oh, Nancy, I think she's going to be very interesting to talk to. I'm looking forward to it. And we're going to be interviewing her. And then you know what? Next month, our July book is about Chief Standing Bear.
So exciting.
Yeah. And so the book is called I Am a Man by Joe Starita. We're going to be learning a lot more about indigenous populations. And I am loving it.
I know. I'm feeling like this is going to be the great entryway into talking about Native American experiences. And I'll tell you what, Joe is going to have some fabulous things to talk with us about what's happening around Chief Standing Bear in Nebraska and the United States. And I am not going to tip my hand on this, but we have some very exciting things that we'll be talking about. But first, we're going to get a nice overview of what's happening with parents and children in the Native American population from Dr. Jacobs.
Very interesting, Nance. You've got me thinking.
Good. Well, I hope that you, our listeners, are enjoying these episodes as much as we enjoy making them. If you do, give us a review or tell a friend. We'd love for more people to join us on the front porch.
Our website is frontporchbookclub.com.
Our episodes come out twice a month on the first and third Wednesdays of every month.
See you next time, Nance.
All right. See you then.